You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program two guys who have been on the program before. And I heard about their work from Bob Nielsen. And Bob asked me, do you know Ken Falk? And I said, no. He said, you got to have him on because they're doing some work in the area of post-traumatic growth. He's a retired Navy guy. So I got on the phone to track down this Falk guy. And I did it. And Ken came on the program. And what he laid out, starting from his work at the EOD, Foundation, was incredible. And they started their place up in Virginia, Boulder Crest Retreat, and so I had him on, and then Josh came on, and Josh is kind of the ops guy, and so. Their work is no stranger to the airwaves here at All Marine Radio. So it's a privilege for me to welcome back Ken Falk and Josh Goldberg. So, guys, first of all, welcome back to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Max. Love being on.
All right. First of all, let's talk about the book. You guys are both first-time authors, why write this? Where did this come from?
Well, yeah, thanks, Max. So, we're first-time authors and co-authors on this book, Struggle Well, Thriving in the Aftermath of Trauma. And really, kind of the thing that got us going on it was we keep getting asked this question, is, you know, the success that we're having with veterans in our Warrior Path program, would it be applicable to civilians? And we kept saying, yeah, and we said yeah for a lot of reasons, you know, even though I guess, you know, military family members aren't necessarily true civilians. You know, we've had a lot of military family members come through. We had a former NFL football player come through one of our programs, and we just said, yeah, we think it'll work, and why don't we share the word? And the only way to do that, I think, in a quick and impactful way is to write a book. So we spent the last year, really, probably since the last time we talked to you, you know, taking some of the learnings and really trying to take the kind of curriculum approach that we take in Warrior Path and put into a book. And at the same time, weaving some of our stories into it as well, some of our personal stories.
So just so everybody knows, if you either click on the Read Board tab on the website or the Blog tab on the website, you'll both find the book where you can check it out on their website and where you can buy it on Amazon. So you can find the book. It's called Struggle Well, and so let's talk a little bit about this. So, is trauma not trauma? Whether you're a firefighter, a police officer, a victim of rape, a victim of domestic violence or violent crime, is trauma different?
Yeah, I mean, I think the long and short of it is no. I mean, trauma is trauma. And I think one of the things, there's a couple of aspects of post-traumatic growth, of this journey we've been on to identify and figure out the other side of the story. We know trauma impacts us. We know it creates a lot of challenges in life. Ken and I both been through that. But we also believe and we know that there's another side to it. And we talked a lot about the Hanoi Hilton guys being wonderful role models for that. And Charlie Plum wrote the foreword to our book, which is a great honor and privilege. And one of the things that differentiates post-traumatic growth is what it looks at trauma and what trauma means. And essentially what happens when you go through traumatic experiences, whatever they are, whether they're multiple or one, is it destroys your belief system about the world and about yourself. And so it shakes your world, it rattles your world in a way that makes it difficult to continue to move forward in any kind of constructive way. And it makes you can't continue the mission. And you really have to recalibrate, take in the end, figure out what you need to do to be able to move forward in the way that you want to. And far too often our mental health system, when it finds people in that state, it locks them in place, right? It medicates them. It has you talk over and over and over about what got you there, but it doesn't give you a path out of it. And it paralyzes you, and it sticks you. And so what we look at when we think about trauma is how do you reconstruct a belief system that allows you to move forward in the way that is true to who you are and what you're capable of doing. And in so many respects, we sat and wrote this book to be prescriptive, to be a roadmap, not to be kind of, you'll know when you see it, sort of a book, but a book that really is designed to share how do you walk the road from struggle to strength, no matter what happens.
All right, let's back up and let's define post-traumatic growth. For people that have never heard that term, I first heard it from Secretary Mattis when he was giving a speech someplace, and I thought, having worked for him, I thought, okay, he's not stupid. If he's saying it, it should probably be something I investigate. So tell everybody, Ken or Josh, tell everybody tell everybody what post-traumatic growth is, and then we have to reintroduce you to everybody so I don't get too far out of kilt. Explain post-traumatic growth. What is it?
Well, I mean, the short thing is, Mac, is kind of what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. I mean, that's the genesis to post-traumatic growth, is that this trauma occurs, and, you know, in the traditional sense of healing, you know, the way PTSD treatments go is this whole concept of, I'm going to go see a doctor, I'm going to get some talk therapy, I'm going to get some medication, and they're going to reduce these symptoms. You know, I got some depression, I've got anxiety, and these symptoms get reduced. The difference with post-traumatic growth is that not only are we reducing symptoms, but we're trying to put into practice, you know, ways that people can go on to thrive and not just kind of survive in life. So in the world of post-traumatic growth, we're looking at, you know, how do you actually come out of these traumatic experiences often, in many cases, better than what you were, you know, prior to going in. You know, that this time of struggle, this time of trauma gives us this opportunity to take a knee and really look within us deeply, like you see these stories, as Josh mentioned, Charlie Plum, 6 years in Hanoi Hilton, how the hell do you come out of that, you know, as a better person? You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's the worst thing that can happen, I think, to a soldier, is to be captured and tortured, and not only for a day or two, but for 6 years. This guy was, like, you know, completely upside down, and then he comes home, and he's like, you know, his wife's gone, and psychiatrists had prepped the families that, you know, these guys would have to go into mental institutions and all sorts of crazy talk. And then all of a sudden these guys come home and they're like, you know, what do you mean we're crazy? Nothing's wrong with us. You know, we've had an amazing experience. Yeah, it sucked, but, you know, we grew deeper together as brothers. Our relationships were enhanced and our spirituality was enhanced. And, you know, we're going to come back and kick some ass. We're going to come back from this war. And as we say here at Boulder Crest, every time somebody comes to our program, is, as warriors, our responsibility after war is to come home and be a productive member of society, not to become another taker, not to become another victim. And that's what post-traumatic growth is. It's how do we thrive after trauma and not just survive.
Josh, anything to pile on to that?
I mean, I think McCann said it really well, and I'm fond of a Joseph Campbell quote that, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. That when you go through these really difficult and challenging experiences, that they are designed to enrich your life and allow your life to be, on the one hand, more serious, but on the other, more fulfilling and more purposeful and more authentic. And so that's what post-traumatic growth is. It's the explanation of why bad things happen to good people. And it's to make us deeper, more profound, more service-oriented, and more authentic, albeit with a more serious view of life and a less frivolous view of life. And I think that nobody captures that better than this community. Nobody. And that's what they've taught me, is that it's in the struggle that we find our strength and our truth.
You know, one of the things that it's interesting is you guys relate these two worlds, because I've grown up in those worlds. My oldest sister, her two sons, they were 6 and 4 years old, were both shot in the head by her husband when she told him that she was leaving him, and then he put the gun in his own mouth and took his own life after he had beaten her. So, I mean, I would tell you that the toughest human being I know on the planet is my big sister, because as much ugliness as I've seen in almost 3 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, none of it happened to my kids. And so I've had nothing certainly that anybody would wish on anybody, but I've seen both these worlds, and I've seen how much they do have in common. Talk to me about obviously what excites you about the book and what it has to say about the lessons that you guys have learned with veterans to other people who lived in a world of violent crime, who've lived in a world of trauma in their lives, and it could be through you know, cancer and death, or could be, you know, could be rape or something else. What does the book hold for people relative to what you guys have learned?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I remember you sharing that story about your sister before, and it's heartbreaking to hear these stories, but we hear them over and over again.
Right.
And by the way, Mac, you're quoted in our book. I don't know if you've read our book yet all the way through, but I know you mentioned you downloaded it. We're going to send you a copy anyway, but I don't know if you remember, but the last time you and Josh were on the phone, you said something to Josh like, you know, hey, you know, listening to your story, you kind of sound a bit like a wuss. And
what?
Josh,
I said that? That doesn't sound like me. Are you sure it was me?
You,
brother. That sounds so insensitive. I can't believe I'd say something like that.
Well, and Jeff, what Josh said is like, you know, compared to you, Mac, you know, maybe I am. And it's like, but what? Here's the story: is that that's the issue with us as humans, is that every one of us are trained throughout our life from day one on how do you. You know, persevere through this adversity. And it's like, that's the, you know, the story of your sister. And it's a story of Josh. You know, our lead therapist here in Virginia, Susie Landolfi, she talks about this concept of 1,000, you know, cuts, right? It's like, yeah, you know, some trauma, as your sister went through, it's a massive impact in a very short period of time, but kind of the things that Josh went through were over a period of his life. But, you know, really what we tried to do in the book was, there's a lot of books about inspiration and post-traumatic growth that are kind of focused on other people's stories. And no disrespect, but, you know, let's just say Sally was in her car and she got in a car accident and she was paralyzed and she went on to win a gold medal in the Paralympics or something. And it's really inspiring, but it doesn't tell you how to do it, you know. And it's, some people are sitting there in the car thinking, or after their car accident thinking, well, I'm not Sally, and I'm not that lucky, and I didn't hit the lottery, you know, whatever the story might be. So what we tried to do was really take our learnings and our teachings of post-traumatic growth, how to achieve this in your life, and kind of create like a prescription through the book on how to do that in a prescriptive way, and at the same time weaving other people's stories and Josh and mine's personal stories kind of through the book. So I think, you know, if you're struggling, And we all believe that no matter who we are in life, struggles never end. It comes till the last day on our deathbed, you know, in some form or fashion, that this book will kind of teach you how to struggle well.
So let me get this straight. So Goldberg, you notice you're not Josh anymore. Goldberg made me the villain in your book? What kind of crap is that?
You're not the. I have a dartboard with your face on it.
I know. It's like, now I know why you didn't return my emails. I became the villain. I mean, I didn't mean worse in a bad way. I meant it in a positive way. If I said it, I don't even know that was me. Did you guys do have a voice print of this thing?
The thing is, it was really like, absolutely don't take any offense, but it's very clarifying, because what I realized is, like, you know, I was trained to be smart, not to be strong, and that's just true. And I was really good at the role that was assigned to me by others. But when it came time for me to have to draw upon intestinal fortitude and resolve and perseverance, I didn't have, there was nothing in the tank. And so, you know, my story, which is really spelled out in the book, was like through a random series of circumstances, I found myself, as somebody who grew up without any connection to the military, amongst veterans who were leading other veterans. And in my case, it was Dusty Baxley, who was also on the show.
Right.
And he helped me find what was inside of me. And I think that there's probably two parts of the book that are really important. One is our belief that in a world that tells you that the answers are outside of you, whether that's in the form of a dog or a drug or some other self-medication or another person who's going to make you happy, is the truth is that what everything we've learned tells us is the answers to the questions you have are within you, and the strength and what you require is within you. And I think the second part of what hardens people to take that journey is hope. And we live in a world where it feels, and Mattis will talk about how victimhood is exalted in America today. And I think I've heard other people talk about this idea that our yesterdays are going to be just like our tomorrows. And it's this idea of like learned hopelessness. We've been taught to believe that each day, as things go on in our lives, we're going to have a lesser existence than we did the day before. And it's this recipe for suicide, for addiction, for aggression, for depression. And for us, and when you tell people that, that's the limits of their world. And I think part of the book is designed to not just give you a roadmap, but to tell you that because of the experiences you've been through, good, bad, and in between, you have the opportunity to live a greater life each and every day as you reflect and make meaning from those experiences. And that's true for me, and I'm a very different person than I was before in amazing ways. And I have been trained to be strong now, and I probably still can't do as many pull-ups as most people, but I have the capacity to persevere in the face of great obstacle in a way that maybe I couldn't before. And I think that's the message of the book. It's that growth and evolution and contribution are your birthright, and people are trying to tell you that it's gone because you've been through shitty circumstances, and we don't believe that. And we don't believe that vehemently, and I know Mattis doesn't believe it, and you don't believe it, because it's a death sentence if we do.
No, you know, and the thing is, you're right, Goldberg. No, we've lived it. We've seen it. We've seen a culture of victimhood, you know, and I'm, these guys are going to get reintroduced in a second, but the single question that I get asked the most from people that hear the program and they reach out is, how do I get off these meds? How do I get the help that I need to be full up brown? How do I learn to live with this? Because I've learned that it's not going away. How do I do that? And the frustration out there, the single greatest frustration among veterans is when I go, they hand me the bag of prescriptions, and they're very nice to me, and I'm an OIF, OEF guy, so they move me to the front of the lines and things like that, and then they tell me to go to group. But nobody helps me, and I hear stories, but nobody has a blueprint for me to get beyond that. And so obviously this is, the blueprint is what's critical. Goldberg, you're just on double secret probation, okay? Till I read whatever the hell you wrote about me.
You're not a villain in the book, though. I think it's just an observation.
Thank you.
I hope. It'll be up to you if that's true or not.
Don't be a victim. No, that's awesome. All right, let's reintroduce you guys. Ken, we'll start with you. First of all, tell everybody your background. Tell everybody how you got to this point. Give us a brief bio.
Yeah, brief bio. I enlisted in the Navy as an E-1 back in 1981, and spent almost 22 years in the Navy, the majority of them as a EOD guy. And that was kind of, you know, my career. I retired and kind of hit the jackpot. I started a small consulting company that did very well and was able to sell the company and, you know, really dedicate the rest of my life to the kind of philanthropy that my wife and I are committed to, which is helping our brothers and sisters who we served with. But early in the way I really got involved and got Boulder Crest up and running was early in the war. We started something called the Wounded EOD Warrior Foundation, which today is the EOD Warrior Foundation. We merged with another older legacy EOD foundation, and basically I since 2004 till today have taken care of, you know, severely wounded EOD troops, the families that have been left behind by the guys who have been killed in action, guys and gals that have been killed in action, and those who have taken their own lives. And one thing led to another. During the height of the amputee problem in Afghanistan, which was kind of like 2010 to 12, we started bringing these families out from Balboa Hospital to our home here in Virginia, about an hour west, and we ended up donating 37 acres of land and put up some of the first big chunks of money to build this beautiful facility here in Virginia. And then last year, one of our biggest donors, the Clark family here in Bethesda, Maryland, gave us a $10 million gift to buy a beautiful facility in Arizona and open up a second facility so we could be a little bit closer to our West Coast brethren. So we're excited, man, about what we're doing, and that's really my short bio.
All right. Goldberg, your turn.
Goldberg, no, grew up in Texas, was a sort of world-class civilian, had a successful civilian life, worked in corporate America, did very well, and had sort of a, not a midlife crisis, probably a third-life crisis when I got to the top of the ladder and realized it was against the wrong building, and I really started to struggle significantly with suicidality and panic attacks and all the rest of it, and tried to figure out. I was like, there has to be a better way to figure out. I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know how to get there. And in the process, I encountered several folks who were working with veterans and asked me to kind of help, and I did. And it led to this fateful moment that's described in the book where I ran into Dusty, and he told me that I wasn't allowed to help other people and take shortcuts, that I had to unfuck myself first, and I did. And in the process, I ended up meeting Ken, and we've been working together for over 4 years now, doing just various things as we look to continue to expand the impact of what we're doing. And then what I'll be doing is we're going to launch the Boulder Crest Institute for Post-Traumatic Growth in September, and I'll be the executive director of that. And that really focuses on taking what we've learned and bringing it out into the world in a way that impacts lots of people. Because as you said, and as the book is reflective of, struggle, suicide, and suffering are not limited to the military and veteran community by any means. And so the question is, how do we take what we learn and really bring it into the world and help as many people as we can every single day?
All right, so we know we got reintroduced to both of you, and so let's talk about, explain to people what you guys do at your locations in Virginia and Arizona. What do you do there? Who shows up? What kind of programs? What's the aim of how long are they there? Explain to everybody what you guys do.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the easier thing first. So about 50% of our calendar years in both locations are set aside for what we call family R&R, which is rest and reconnection time. So really, you know, guys and gals separated by long deployments and families separated by long deployments come together and can, you know, stay at our retreat facility one time a year for 2 to 7 nights. And if they stay for 2 nights, that's one time. If they stay for 7, that's one time. So one time a year. And the only qualifications to come and stay here is that you have to be a combat veteran, have to have served. You know, doesn't necessarily mean you had to have, you know, been out of the wire or any of that, but, you know, been able to show that you were involved in the fight and that you have an honorable discharge. And those are the requirements for staying here. And, you know, we know the VA is opening up their, you know, mental health care other than honorable discharges, and we may do that at some point, but we're just a small foundation, two small facilities, so we have to kind of find our sweet spot, and that's what we do. And then the other half of the year, and again, it's all woven through the calendar. It's not 6 months and then 6 months, but woven through the calendar, we do these PATH programs. And PATH stands for Progressive and Alternative Training, not therapy, but training for healing heroes. And the reason we did that, Mac, was because what we heard at the VA and through the RAND studies was that the two biggest issues with mental health care and veterans is one is the stigma associated with it, and two is the what they call the lack of cultural attunement, meaning that most military personnel don't connect with their therapist, you know, on the first or second visit like you would a fellow soldier. So what we wanted to do is we said, well, let's not do therapy, let's do a training program, because, you know, most military people like training, and we look forward to what our next training course is. So we said, let's do a training course. And then the majority of our staff are peers, other combat veterans who, you know, can break that wall of get to know you and trust and all the things that are required to heal, especially in a quick, you know, condensed program like we run. Those things happen because you can make friends, you know, really quickly. So we have two Marines here on our staff, combat, you know, Marines on our staff, so if a Marine shows up, you know, the chest beating doesn't go on for a long time. They, you know, get to know each other pretty quickly. So, so those PATH programs, are focused, we call it our flagship program because that's where the science is being. Flagship program's called Warrior PATH, and that program is in fact focused on the combat veteran themselves. And, then we do a whole family PATH program. And the Family Path program is focused on the whole family unit. So there's some warrior-only work, there's some couples work, there's some spouse work, and there's some work with the kids as well. And then we do a three-day program focused on the couples, kind of a marriage enrichment kind of program. And then the fourth program we do are for caregivers, which are primarily spouses. And what we've seen here in our caregiver program mostly is, you know, young wives of guys who have been severely injured or have, you know, PTSD issues, those types of kind of programs. And again, they're not as intense as Warrior Path or Family Path, those three-day programs, just because we don't have the time. But, you know, they're a great break for people, and they're a great way to start a new conversation in your relationship. So in all of our programs, we're working with Accenture, a partner of ours, who's developing an app for us called My Path, which will basically have 18 months worth of online training in it, and all of our PATH participants will be able to use that, you know, before they come to us or after they leave. So this isn't just what we would call a catch and release program. You know, you're not just the mountains of Virginia or the mountains of Arizona to shoot turkeys and whatever else. It's to come and work hard to make your life and make you a better person and make your life a better place to be.
Okay, can we just, in terms of how long do these programs take, the Warrior Path, how long is that?
So technically it's an 18-month program because there's an 18-month follow-up.
Okay.
We've been doing it now with phone calls and Zoom and, you know, Skype, right, and those types of, but the app will be much more structured. But the intense retreat part of it for Warrior Path is 7 days, for Family Path, 5, and then the other two, couples and caregivers, programs are three-day programs.
Is there any difference between what you do in Virginia as opposed to what you do in Arizona?
Well, we're 5 years old in Virginia, so we're a little more, the schedule's a little more intense. We're training our staff in Arizona, so this year, 2018, is going to be a little bit lighter of a year, but we hope by next year, by January of 19, we're, you know, fully up and running and at equal pace to what we've been doing now in Virginia.
Got it.
The other, and that thing I want to say, though, is some of your listeners might be going, what the hell can happen in 7 days? First and foremost, the transformation in almost every case is beyond. We've had two doctors studying this program now for about 18 months, and one of them said one time that he sees changes in people in 2 days here that would take the mental health community 12 to 14 months. That's pretty substantial. But if you remember, if you take 7 days, and it's like a military training day. We go from 7 in the morning until 8:30 at night. If you take that and add it up over the 7 day period, it's 74 hours of contact time. So, you know, if you saw a therapist for an hour a week, that's 16 months worth of therapy in a very short period. So we think the intensity of the program, you know, the fact that we have a very focused peer-to-peer model, and then the 18-month follow-up really makes it unique.
Josh, anything to add to that?
No, yes. The thing I'd add is what we see in our programs, what inspired us to write the book, are our results and success and data that make the mental health system, make our current approach, like you described, of guys getting tired of being on medication and things that don't work, and just make it pale in comparison. And then, you know, we measure symptom reduction, of course, and we see guys going from an average of having clinical diagnosis of PTSD to anxiety and depression to well below those levels in a way that they can live their life and live it the way they want to. And then we look at quality of life, relationships, financial wellness, education, employment, alcohol and drug use, things like that, and then post-traumatic growth, which is what do you believe about life? And we see results that are profound, in part because, you know, we take a comprehensive look at what's going on, and most importantly, at a comprehensive look at what is somebody struggling with and where do they want to go, and how do we help train them in a way that allows them to get to the places they want to go. And we don't put a limiting factor on them, and we don't put a goal on top of them. So I think we're proud of what we've done, and I think the goal is to continue to bring it to more people. So in addition, like you mentioned, we opened Arizona last year. We've got the Institute coming out. We're partnering with organizations in other states to be able to deliver PATH in their places and be what we call past partners so that we can continue to create a group of organizations all dedicated to a different approach that actually works.
You know, again, what Josh just said that actually works, therein lies the difference. You know, there's so many, you know, the three of us could tell stories about the different people we've crossed paths with that are so frustrated because they're trying and they've had this experience and they can't shake it and people, you know, have their in their family have said, I just want you to be the guy that you used to be. And we all want to be the guy that we used to be, but you are still that guy, but you're a little bit more than that guy used to be. And how do you get your hands around it? How do you do it? And I'll tell you this: when I interviewed Ken, and then I interviewed Josh, and then I interviewed Dusty, the amount of email I got, you know, the feedback, and people were saying, finally something that offers us something other than a bag of drugs and beginning to go to group therapy, not connecting with a therapist, and then stopping going altogether. Finally something from people that sound like they get us and how exciting that was. So you guys know what a fan I am of what you do. I want to go back to the book. One of the things that I first learned, and it might have been I first heard Ken say it, or I might have read it in something that he had his name on, or maybe it was a speech that he gave, and that was the low percentage of post-traumatic stress in prisoners of war. And you think of people that endured such a violent, horrible existence would have come back shattered human beings, and yet they didn't. Can talk about that and because it's astounding when you hear that. And one of them writes the foreword, Charlie Plum. First of all, who the hell is Charlie? Before you answer that, who's Charlie Plum?
Yeah, so Charlie Plum was a Navy lieutenant at the time. He retired as a Navy captain, but a lieutenant on the Saratoga, and he took off for his 75th combat mission 5 days before he was supposed to come home from the Vietnam War, from his deployment. And he was shot down and captured and ultimately made his way into the famous Hanoi Hilton and spent 6 years of his life there. And yesterday, for your listeners, if you Google it, his first TEDx. I mean, this guy's given thousands of speeches since he came home from the prison camps. But yesterday he launched his first TEDx talk at in California, and if you look at, I think it's TEDx Oaks, and it's amazing. I posted it on the Boulder Crest Retreat Facebook page too, but it's an amazing 15-minute story of his life. But, you know, I always say to people, and you know, Charlie's on our honorary board here at Boulder Crest Retreat, but I always say to people that, to me, Charlie Plum is like the epitome of post-traumatic growth. If you could create the poster child for it. I mean, it's Charlie Plum, and because he had not, you know, he got back. Like I said, he got back. His wife had left him. She thought he was dead, so he got back. He, you know, the things that kept him hopeful in this prison camp was, you know, eating a hamburger and getting back to his wife. You know, and he got back to his wife, or got back to the States, and his wife had left him and remarried. So, you know, that was, you know, another kick in the nuts. So, you know, 6 years in prison camp, being tortured and beaten, everything that goes along with that, and losing weights and infections on your body, and, you know, the worst that warfare has to offer. And then to come home thinking all this hope you've created for yourself, it could have been really easy for him to put his gun in his mouth. And,
I had an argument years ago about the movie Castaway. And I saw the movie Castaway, and I said, "Hey, that movie's bullshit. I'm on that island, and I stay alive all those years to come back to my wife. And through some mistake, she's married to another guy, and I'm just going to let that go. Yeah, I don't think that's happening." And it wasn't being a big discussion, but what you're describing is the actual human event in which that happens. Oh, by the way, piled on to 6 years of being a prisoner of war in Vietnam, of all places. That's not right. That's not right, but that's his life. that's his life. The so when you first heard that about the low amount of post-traumatic stress, how did that impact you? What did you think? Did your brow furl and say that can't be right? What's the truth in all this? Talk about how that impacted you and what direction it sent you.
Well, you know, when the doctor said to me, so I've been in combat and I've been to SEER school. So when the doctor said to me, he said 30% of Vietnam vets came home from the war with PTSD, which arguably, Mac, is kind of true for our current generation. And he said, what percentage do you think of POWs from Vietnam came home with PTSD? And I said, 100%? He's like, no, and I'm 50, you know, 30, and he holds his hands up, you know, with four fingers and says, no, four. And I'm like, what? You know, there's no way in hell. How do you come out of that, you know? And then the other thing that was kind of, as I started thinking about it, the other thing that I had seen, because I'd been bedside, you know, for 200 severely wounded EOD guys since 2002, I'd been bedside in these hospitals at Walter Reed and Bethesda and Brooks Army Hospital down in San Antonio, Balboa, anywhere our guys got medevaced. You know, I'd met all these young guys who had some pretty severe physical injuries. And one of my Navy EOD guys, Taylor Morris, he lost all four limbs. And you're going, but when you're around Taylor Morris, it's like when you're around Charlie Plum, you want to be that guy. And it's like these guys are so positive that they've faced this adversity. They've gone on to do some remarkable things because they're not sitting in the corner, you know, doing drugs and whacked out on all these drugs that the therapist put them in, and they found ways of coming home and being productive. Taylor Morris, I'll just give you an example. This guy, so this is a young man who lost all four limbs. In my entire time at the hospital, including single leg amputees, which is arguably, you know, you get one leg and you can balance on your prosthetic, including single leg amputees, I never saw anybody up on prosthetic legs walking as fast as Taylor Morris. And on his whiteboard, him and his girlfriend had these goals, like every day I'm gonna do this. You know, once these wounds on my stubs are healed, I want my legs on and I want to be able in 3 weeks to walk around the track, you know, unattended or unsupported or whatever the words were. He got a prosthetic arm and he wanted to get the pressure just right in his fingertips, and he wanted to be able to eat this brownie without crushing it and work over and over. And I kept saying, you know, hey, Taylor, you know, this is amazing, you know, because guys who set goals are going to kick ass in life. And then the guy gets out of the hospital in a very short period of time compared to many physical injuries. He gets out of the hospital, and he's back in college. He just graduated last spring with his bachelor's degree. Him and his grandfather raised a shitload of money to build a veterans memorial in their small town in Iowa. He's now opened up this thing called a maker space where he lets people come in and work on, you know, 3D printers and other types of things to, you know, allow them to, you know, have a kind of a shared co-op workspace. And this guy's, I mean, he's an entrepreneur. He's on, you know, his right. Wife, who was his girlfriend when he was in the hospital, finished her master's degree while he was doing his bachelor's degree. She got a real estate license. Every day on Facebook, it looks like she sold another house. So it's like mind-blowing what people can do when they put their mind to it. And like Charlie Plum, when I first looked at Taylor, I thought, man, this guy's got a long road ahead of him. He's got a tough life ahead of him, but he's making it look easy.
All right, so let's talk about. Well, let me ask you a question, and then I want you both to walk us through the book. What's the difference between people that take to it like a, you know, some people swim easily, right? Like a fish in water. And that oversimplifies it, I know. But what's the difference between people that seem to adjust quicker and people that take longer?
Well, I mean, I think in a word, at least when we look at the Hanoi Hilton example, you say leadership. And I think we can all agree that that's sorely lacking in our world in every respect. I mean, right. with all due respect, and I mean that in deference to mental health people, they're not great leaders. And I think ultimately, when you get into this world, what you're looking for is somebody who can help you navigate the darkness to find that light. And I think that that's what's lacking. And I would humbly submit, you know, Ken and I have done our own work, and we've done a lot of work with folks who are struggling, and we can continue to do so. And I think we feel capable and competent in serving in that leadership role. And I think that that's part of what's missing. That's one. And I think the other is perspective. And when you look at Jim Stockdale, who's the senior residing officer there in the Hanoi Hilton, and the perspective he enshrined in the people who were there to focus on what they could focus on, that just because they were in a prison didn't make them a prisoner, that they would have a full recognition and an honest reckoning of just how bad their situation is, just how fucked up it is, and they would always keep the faith to know that they would be better and they would thrive because of their experiences. And so I think that sense and that those ideas are what allow somebody to navigate the really, really challenging times, believing and recognizing that they have what they need to be able to get through them. And the short answer, I mean, so the two doctors we work with, Rich Tedeschi, who's the father of post-traumatic growth, and Brett Moore, who was at one point the longest deployed psychologist in Army history, they are writing a book right now that looks at why post-traumatic growth is essentially synonymous with the military and veteran community. And so when I think about veterans and their families and military service members, it is that community that understands this at a very, very deep level. And we just have to remind people that the same attributes that made you successful downrange are going to make you successful in this battle against yourself in a lot of respects and against the struggle you're going through. And I think not that you don't need a new set of skills, but you need to apply the same degree of discipline and leadership and commitment to this challenge as you do anything else in your life.
And, Mac, the other thing I'd add is that the Marine Corps did a really interesting study on this leadership thing. Because when I talk about PTSD to guys in groups, I say, you know, I think PTSD is as much of a leadership issue as it is a mental health issue. And people say, well, how can you say that? And I said, well, the Marine Corps did a study, and they show that well-led Marine Corps units had a much lower suicide rate than the opposite. And when those types of things are said, you know, in these studies, it's like you start to think, well, you know, what truth is this? And I think I told you the last time we interviewed, a Marine Corps general friend of mine said to me, you know, he said, Ken, every Marine that I ever talked to when they were transitioning out of the Marine Corps, what I would say to them is, do not let the Marine Corps be the last great thing you do in life. And I think sometimes, what if everybody had that? I mean, just that one small thing. Everybody who tracked out of the service. But no, if that doesn't happen, right, we throw you into a wounded warrior regiment or a warrior transition unit, whatever it might be,
right.
And, you know, you're treated like a dirt bag, because you're not deployable or, you know, whatever it might be, and that last part of your military experience is, you know, is terrible, and then you're back in the civilian society, completely disconnected. You can see why our brothers and sisters are, you know, taking their own lives. This ain't rocket science. It's a lack of leadership, and I think that's what Josh and I are trying to do with this book is to say, hey man, the world seems like it's in a bit of a funk right now. It's like 20 veterans a day taking their own lives. And I'll go back. Let me go back one more, Matt. So one active duty troop a day, service-wide, statistically, one active duty troop a day takes his own life. 20 veterans. So you tell me where the disconnect is. And there's no leadership in the veteran space. You know, even well-led companies, you know, where they've got these core values posted on the wall when you walk in, you know, it's bullshit. You know, you go into your cubicle, you do your job, you get up, and people next to you, it's all about a race to the top and who can get there first and how they can step on you while they're getting you. That's what corporate America is. That's not what the military is about. So you can see how this disconnection occurs, but it's a big leadership. That's something that we hope that the book will help with.
The book right now is called Struggle Well, right? You go to either the read board on the All Marine Radio website, or you can do a search on that on the internet. You'll find it, or you can go to the blog page on All Marine Radio, and you can find it. You can find the link to the website for the book, and that is strugglewell.com. And you can also find a link to Amazon to purchase it. Let me ask you, I got the emails about the book being available for 99 cents. Is that already over?
So no, it's just to be clear, that's the Kindle version only, and it's
right.
For 2 days, and then it goes back up to $9.99, and then I think the paper batch are like $15.99. But hey, do us a favor and send us your address. We'll send you one just so you have one, and we'll.
Well, now that I'm a villain in a book, Goldberg.
Exactly. Goldberg. I'll find your Kindle copy, Mac.
Goldberg better sign the son of a bitch. I want to walk through now, as you guys have broadened the lens, you've taken what you all have learned, because, you know, it's funny, because, you know, the things I tell veterans, one, understand that the experience you went through doesn't need to be debilitating. Two, there's a lot of people on the planet that suffer from post-traumatic stress. We don't have the market cornered, so you're a part of a larger group. And three, when you begin to help other people, and you know that other people have it a lot worse than you do, right? And I'm not afraid to bring my sister up when I talk about this stuff. You will begin to enter a new phase of your life in which you can grow and help other people. I want to talk about concepts that you guys talk about in the book. Talk about the struggle. It's a chapter that you guys call Struggle Well, Live Well. Talk about the shame game. Talk about those two things, guys. And so when people read your book, you know, a little bit about what's inside it, because I think those are hugely important comments. And then the next chapter we talk about those things. I want to talk about serving others. And so how about it? Struggle well, live well.
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about that, Max. And I think that the interesting thing about struggle is that, you know, I always tell people, and I think I said this on your last show too, but I'll say it again, is that, you know, our lives are kind of like a sine wave. And the smoother that sine wave can look, right, these ups and downs in our life, the smaller the peaks and valleys are, and the narrower the gaps are in between them, or the wider the gaps are in between them, is really what decent struggle looks like, right? So we're born and we have children and, you know, children get married and there's this high, and then, you know, you buy your kid a new car and she wrecks it, and, you know, you go to combat and you've got this real adrenaline high, and then your best friend's killed and you've got this low, and it's like all these kind of things that kind of weave through our life. And what I tell people is if you can get that in your mind, this kind of ups and down roller coaster of life, and imagine that the way that bandwidth is kind of encompassed in two lines, you know, one that holds you up from the bottom, and the bottom being depression, and one that prevents you from going too high at the top, which really is anxiety. And what happens in those two bands is really is this ability on the bottom of the sine wave is this ability to self-regulate. So what we teach and what we talk about are self-regulation practices, exercise, yoga, meditation, things that allow you to get the good chemicals in your body, the natural chemicals in your body, to make you feel good about yourself, right? Not to have to over-medicate to try to get that to happen for you unnaturally, but to do it naturally. Things we learned in the military.
Right.
And getting up in the PT, we all felt great after PT. You know, maybe your knees hurt or your back, but it was, you know, I can just speak for my career. It was something I looked forward to every morning, and it was something that I always felt good about starting the day afterwards. And these are what we call regulation practices, right? And maybe it's in the financial sense of life. Financial wellness is a big thing for a lot of veterans too, that especially those that are unemployed, is that not spending more money than you make. And, you know, it sounds easy, but I mean, so many of our peers are financially distraught. I mean, it's terrible to see some of the problems that are happening in this space, you know, because they have to have new cars, and they think the best thing to do is buy a house instead of renting a house, and then they can't afford the mortgage payments, and just all sorts of disasters in the financial world. So, and what we say on that part of the road, you know, if you can imagine this being a road and the two lines on the road, that line is really the line that allows you to have that self-control. Because if you can't self-regulate, you tend to self-medicate, and then we all know where that goes, right? If you're doing, you know, drugs, whether they're illegal or legal and being illegally used, or you're drinking a lot, smoking a lot of dope, it's not going to allow you to thrive in life. Those things hold us back. And by the way, neither of us are teetotalers. We like a cigar. We like a scotch. But I'm telling you now that if you're abusing it, then your life is a disaster. It's just nothing good comes out of that. And then on the other line on the road is really what we call your network. And as humans, we thrive on connection. We thrive on relationships. And we tend to become the average of the kind of 3 to 5 people we spend the most time with in our lives. So if you're spending those 3 to 5 people are drunks, you're probably going to be sitting at the bar with them and drinking. But if you can put good people around you and prune the negative people out of your life, and I include that family members in that. And I tell, I have a portion of my family that I don't even talk to anymore just because they're so negative, and every time you're around them, it's like they want something, normally money, and it's just, you can never do enough, and it's like, how do you get rid of them? You just kind of push them out of your life, and it's hard. It's hard to push family members out of your life. It's hard to push friends out of your life, but if they're not healthy and you have this toxicity in your relationship, nothing good's going to come out of that. So those are really the two lines of life. So first of all, normalizing struggle. Everybody has it. I don't care who you are, how rich you are, how poor you are, you're going to have struggle in your life. And how to normalize it and take care of yourself by creating these positive networks around you and having these great practices that allow you to do wellness. And that's really what kind of struggle well, live well is about.
All right. Talk to me about the shame game.
Sure. So, that picture that Ken just painted isn't the way most people live. And in fact, it's, at least if the two of us were a good example, is when you go through and you struggle and you find good teachers and good supporters, you find good practices, you tend to actually go from that, you go from where you were to that wave. And most people live and don't struggle well. Otherwise, we wouldn't have written the book, the title of that. They struggle poorly. And when you struggle poorly, and Ken described kind of the lanes on the road, you weave in like a drunk driver all over the place. And the reason why that's true, the reason why most people struggle is because of a couple things. One is we are a function of our training and our experiences in life. Until and unless we understand them, we're a function of a bunch of patterns we often don't even understand. And my life, my previous life, is a testament to all sorts of things that I did, of training that I received, that I acted upon that led me to a situation where you told me that I was pussy. So, for example, don't take offense, which is why I don't think I am anymore.
Hey, let me just, first of all, you should be honored because I don't care about, I don't call pussies, okay? I call my kids pussies.
Well,
my sons are both infantry officers, largely compensating for that quality of parenting. So you should feel honored, Josh.
I do. I feel honored, and I'm grateful because it makes me feel part of an honorary part of this community, which is awesome. So, but that's part of it. And then we start to struggle, right? We start to struggle, and what happens? Ken just described the positive side of that. The negative side is we reach out to unhealthy habits, we self-medicate, and we also surround ourselves with shitty people. And in part, those people encourage us to do the things we shouldn't be doing.
Right.
They also make us feel better about ourselves, because if I'm not as bad as my buddy who's cheating on his wife and drinking all the time, if I'm only doing 20% of what he's doing, I actually feel like I'm a decent human being when I know that I'm not. So there's those two things that really exacerbate struggle. And ironically, there's a lot of socially acceptable ways of trying to deal with struggle, of self-medicating, between drinking and prescription meds and all these things that don't end up helping us in any way. And so that's just a little bit of the context. Where the shame part fits in is, we talk a lot about, obviously, when we think about combat veterans, and I know you have your personal experience, and there's a perception that so much of it has to do with what was seen on the battlefield. And what I would tell you more often than not, what we see folks struggling with is the way they were to the people they cared about because of what happened, right? There's a direct line, but it's this idea that when they had their kid peeing their pants because they screamed at them, right, when there was fear on the eyes of the people they swore to protect, it are the moments when you begin to question, am I a monster, right? How could I do these things? And so what you accumulate is a bunch of guilt and shame that inhibits your ability to connect with other people and yourself. And it really forces you to start to reflect upon who you've become. And by the way, that creates a vicious cycle. right? So you start to feel self-loathing, you start to feel shameful or guilty, and then what do? Well, you don't usually deal with it constructively. You try to self-medicate it away. You isolate. You spend time in your man cave by yourself, which we know is not healthy for humans. Ken just said we need connection to thrive, right? And it just becomes this vicious cycle of, you know, I'm waiting in line at the store. It's taking too long. I get pissed off. I throw my shit down. I scream, and I walk out of the store, right? And then what happens? And it becomes this cycle. So for us, so much of this struggle well game is an inside-out play, right? It's looking within. And one of the things that prevents us from seeing us for who we truly are is the shame we carry and the guilt we carry for, A, some of the things that happened as we've gone about life, but also some of the things we've done that we're not proud of. And so for us, it's, A, understanding and being able to look back at some of that stuff and talking to people who you know won't judge you and who are going to greet those with empathy. So, you know, I can call up Ken and be like, hey, man, I fucked up. This is what I did. And when he can be like, that's okay, right? I get it. Understand. Sometimes there's a consequences for that.
And Ken has never called you a pussy?
No.
Hey, but I got
shit, hey, man. Mac, what is up with you? You're an EOD guy. You got your tough guys.
Mac, I got to tell you this, though. Josh is interviewing with some comedian on a podcast, and he's talking about me teaching him how to hunt. I'm taking him out. I live on a farm. I'm taking him out deer hunting because he's never hunted, right? So I'm taking him out deer hunting, and she goes, what are you, living with a redneck? And I'm like, she's calling me a redneck for hunting? What the hell's wrong with these people? So,
exactly.
Anyway, we're even, so I appreciate you having my back.
No problem, Ken, anytime. Josh, I'm sorry for the interruption, okay?
No.
You can see I'm not, you know, I'm not good with, you know, any kind of criticism of myself, okay? I'm a fragile human being. But can I hop in? One of the things you said that I say to people, or you kind of alluded to it, is be gentle with yourself through all of this. You know, if you think you're going to, you know, like ask how many Marines quit dipping cold turkey. I just had a buddy of mine who declared on All Marine Radio last week, you know, I'm one of those guys that I have that kind of constitution where, you know, when I say that I'm going to do it, I do it. Like, oh, really? Okay. So he was on again today. Somebody sent in an email. Hey, Mac, ask the gunner how he's doing with dipping. And his response, like, the connection's weak and unreadable, man. I got to go. I said, what do you mean? I can't hear you anymore. I don't know what you're saying. I'm like, uh-oh, there you go. But, you know, it's one of those things that I think people get, as Ken was talking about, those highs and that lows, and like, hey, this is not easy. Be gentle with yourself. Be forgiving of yourself. Keep making steps forward, and guess what? You'll get there. But if you're gonna accelerate the downward movement with disappointment and anger and whatnot, it's not helpful. So be gentle, be understanding. And again, those are not Marine-like. You're a pussy is Marine-like, right? Be gentle. Where does that come from? Okay, I'm not exactly sure, but it's an essential element of tribal, of post-conflict, post-traumatic tribal life for our tribe, certainly.
And it is, and it's why, like, when we talk about this idea, you're the average of the 3 to 5 people you spend the most time with. It's I feel like, you know, I'm a person who lives by integrity. We all make mistakes, but I can tell you definitively, I have 5 people in my life who, if I did something really, really out of line with my own moral compass, I know I could tell them, and not that they would enable me, they would hold me accountable, but they would also provide the support I need, because it is important that we're able to forgive ourselves, but we all know how hard that is. And, you know, the number of times I've seen, I mean Matt, the story that I'll never forget is sitting with 2 guys who we randomly paired together to just do this one exercise in Virginia, and they both killed a kid in combat, and they both could not forgive themselves. And one guy talked about it, and the other guy said, I did the same thing. I forgive you. And the other dude forgave him. But they could not find it within themselves to forgive themselves, but they would allow another person who had shared experience and context to forgive them. And I think that is when we talk about shame and guilt, is the ability to let just express these things and recognize, by the way, that the odds that you are like alone in doing this thing are so low that it doesn't make sense. And that's the part to me is not just being kind to yourself, which is critical because we're not that good at it, but it's also surrounding yourself with people who enable you to be kind to yourself and who help you take accountability for your actions and forgive yourself for the times that you weren't the person you wanted to be, because that's life. That's how we get better, right? By screwing up.
Having said that, this concept of serving others, right? I mean, if you're a leader, one of the things I think that has helped me is I had somebody tell me a long time ago, after a helicopter crash, you'll never get over this. And it was before we did mental health in the military. So there was one of the things I've learned that I think is pretty interesting is there was this oral tradition passed down by Marines giving each other advice that came from guys who gave them advice. It's pretty interesting. I had Jeremiah Workman on, who's a Navy Cross recipient in Fallujah in 2004, and he's written a book called The Shadow of the Sword, and it's about his bout with guilt because he didn't think he acted quick enough in a firefight in which they killed 24 insurgents, but three of his Marines were killed, and then he becomes the recipient of the Navy Cross. Well, now he's a celebrity for the very thing that he hates himself for, and his struggle with alcoholism, his struggle with suicidal ideations, and in one case his father-in-law intervening to keep him from killing himself. And so you watch people go through these things, and so the leadership part of me, though, resonated with you'll never get over this. Okay, I know that. I need to share that with other people. Talk to us about this whole concept of serving others and how that is significant in terms of moving forward and growing from whatever trauma that you're associated with.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Matt, is shame on that person for telling you you'll never get over it. Because that's the biggest crock of shit I've ever heard. Charlie Plum got shot down and, you know, in his airplane. I mean, if anybody was ever going to fly again, it's a guy that's shot down in his airplane and tortured for 6 years. But the guy, to this day, still flies.
Well, I think, Ken, it was the best advice I've ever gotten in my life. And let me complete his thought. You'll never get over this. All right, but you'll learn how to live with this.
Got it. Okay.
You know what I mean? And so, but I mean, I got that in before, you know what I mean? And Jeremiah Workman told me, he said, you know, Mac, I got some great advice. Jeremiah, don't let the monkeys out of the cage. You let those PTSD monkeys start running around and they'll raise holy hell up in that head. So keep it in there. Keep it walled off. That's Vietnam era, PTS. And where did that come from? Korea? World War II? Wall that shit off and don't go near. Put the monkey in the jack in the box. Shut the lid and don't go near that hand crank. So I it's really to me that's the oral history of post combat related mental health or trauma it as handed down largely from high school educated guys to each other and how you cope with it. So I find it interesting. So anyway, go ahead.
The other thing is. Maybe the Vietnam War aside, because they flew back as well, but you look at, you know, pre-Vietnam, you know, and it was a long time to get back home. And you know, you had this ability, you know, in medieval times, you might walk 60 or 70 days before you got back from a battle. And a lot of this pressure and decompression occurred naturally. Around World War II, when you were taking a ship back, you know, my grandfather came back from Germany and they stopped in Iceland and, you know, they went from Iceland to, I think, Nova Scotia, and from Nova Scotia to New York, and then from New York he got bussed back to Pittsburgh or something crazy. But it's like that journey in itself was some level of decompression. And, you know, you look today, especially like special ops guys, I mean, they're on a plane, they fly over, they do two or three, you know, weeks or months of missions every single night, they're back on a plane, they're back home, and the next day they got to act like everything's normal. And that's, you know, that's crazy because you go from this crazy, you know,
life, and then you're saying, okay, we'll just shut it off, and there's no way to decompress or, you know, to do that. But I'm glad you clarified the second half of that statement, because I do get worried about, you know, advice giving. And we talk about this in our book, is that, you know, we think that the most powerful advice, if you will, kind of quote unquote, comes from shared experiences. So that guy that told you that, you know, assuming he was in a helicopter crash and that was his outcome. But, you know, the last thing you want in life is a bunch of advisors who don't have any experience. And right. We see this a lot. And as humans, we're quick to give advice. As soldiers, you know, in the Navy, we used to call them sea lawyers. And, you know, that everybody's got this bit of advice, you know, and then and giving this advice quickly, you know, doesn't allow the individual to make the changes and choices. So, you know, it falls into, you know, I think they call them helicopter parents when you tell your kids what to do. And, you know, we don't want to be helicopter leaders. We want people to think for themselves and be effective. I mean, there's times when we don't have that, you know, luxury, but for the most part, you know, that's what makes people to survive and thrive, and that's what allows them to get these great leadership qualities. So I think it's, you know, it's really important to talk to people and get this network around you of these shared experiences. You want good financial advice? Find a good financial advisor. You know, don't just walk into your buddy who's bankrupt or hit the jackpot the day before because he bought a couple shares of, you know, Bitcoin, and now he's a, you know, a millionaire, and Bitcoin's dropped. You know, you bought it the next day because you took his advice, and now it's dropped, you know, $1,300 a share, and you've lost all your money. So, you know, it's really important, I think, to seek out experts as you try to create this network around you, because, you know, really, really bad advice leads a lot of us into some bad areas.
All right,
and Mac,
go ahead.
And I think, you know, I was talking to some Navy captains recently, and I said to them, you know, the one part that strikes me the most about the story of the Hanoi Hilton is there wasn't an embedded mental health professional within sight. You know, and I think that you're absolutely right that on the one hand, we can propagate, like, you know, boys don't cry and suck it up and don't let the PTSD. There's a whole series of unhelpful, you know, unhealthy ways of doing things. But the flip to that is that there's a lot of value in people who've been the man in the arena. You know, we've got it in Arizona hanging, that quote from Teddy Roosevelt, who lost his wife and his mom within 6 hours of each other.
Yeah.
And people who've been there and done it. And I think for us, when I look at mental health as somebody who did not find the answers I was seeking, is I believe fundamentally we have to re-democratize mental health, and that we have to take care of each other, and that we have to be, you know, and this idea of kind of live it to give it, that we have to take care of ourselves and be able to share, like Ken said, those things we've learned along our journey. And there's a great guy, if you believe that necessity is the mother of invention, this guy, Vikram Patel, who worked in India and Rwanda and other places, and he's used peer-based networks to support people with mental health. And there's a program in Zimbabwe. These grandmas just go sit on a bench, and people come up, and they talk to them about their issues. And these grandmothers are kind and supportive and have lots of wisdom. And these folks do 30% better than people who go to mental health. And the whole idea is that judgment and openness and empathy go so far and go a long way. And so, you know, I'd like to think that people are willing to tell me anything and don't worry about how I'm going to respond, because that I can hold what they can share. And I think in so many ways that gets back to the shame stuff of we're afraid to share things because we don't want people to judge us. Because literally everyone we encounter is judging each other to try to make them feel better about themselves, right? And we got to stop doing that. We got to take care of each other like they did in the Hanoi Hilton. And I think that's what we're also talking about, is giving – the book's not just for people struggling. It's for people who know people who are struggling, to equip you with the language, the understanding, to be able to support them and to use your own experiences to do that, not to use your diploma to do that.
My guests today are the authors of a book entitled Struggle Well. Ken Falk, and retired United States Navy, is one of the founders of the EOD Warrior Foundation. And then I met Josh, who's his co-author, Josh Goldberg. Josh, I was recommended, hey, have Josh on the program. He's the ops guy here. He's putting together all the programs. Over a year ago, they've been gracious enough to come on the program before, and now we're talking about their book, Struggle Well. that right now is available on Amazon.com for 99 cents. In the Kindle version, the paperback's $15.99. So here's the general part of the court-martial, the general question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you, Ken, about this book that you want to make sure that people know?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think it's a matter of what you haven't asked. There's two things I'd like to say at the end, just to kind of tag on to where Josh was going, and this whole concept. In the Hanoi Hilton, they called it being your brother's keeper. And the other day I read this really interesting quote. It said, "We're not our brother's keepers, we're our brother's makers." And it's a pretty interesting quote when you think about how you can help people, you know, get through life. But I think, you know, really what I want people to take away is that one is that I don't care who we are in life, you're going to struggle. There's nothing we can do to turn that off. It just doesn't happen. And, you know, you can't live your whole life in the rearview mirror of your car, right? I mean, what's happened has happened. We can't change what happened 5 minutes ago, let alone what happened, you know, 5 years ago or 55 years ago. We can't change that. And to know that everybody's walking around with these stories, and that I think sometimes just knowing that gives us a little bit of strength. But then the next level of strength I think that's needed is to know that you've got to make some hard choices in your life. You know, it's just, you know, we say there's two really important questions in life that lead you in two different directions. One is why me, which kind of creates this exalted victimhood, or the other question is why. And the question why is sometimes often deep. And if you get into these deep questions and ask, what's going on in my life? Why is this happening to me? You know, rather than telling everybody on Facebook, you know, turn your computer off for a minute and go think about what's going on. Write some things down and journal about it and talk about what's going on in my life and how can I change this and how can I, you know, find the people that I need in my network to help me get better. Because, you know, I see things on Facebook. I was tracking a friend the other night who's, you know, he's probably sounds like he's ready to give up on his life, but I hate people. People suck. And, you know, you're not going to be around on this planet very long if that's your attitude. You know, it's you know, civilians and military people are different, but they're different in a good way. And I think that we've got to figure out how to live, how to be the leaders of this society. And because you see what happens when you don't have leadership. I mean, it's just every single day you can turn the TV on and see something, you know. The VA doesn't have a leader. Everybody's worried, you know, which way is the VA going? And to the average soldier at the average hospital getting treatment, it doesn't really matter who the leader at the VA is, but it surely matters to thousands of people in that organization about who's going to lead us, what direction are they taking us in, you know, do we just stay with the status quo? And it's just, it always happens. So, you know, what we hope is that people read the book, find some inspiration, hope, check out our website. Some of the forms that we suggest you do are on our website, you know, and don't ever hesitate to reach out to us directly. We're both very open on social media, and our email addresses are on our website. And, you know, we're happy to you know, take questions and, you know, do what we can do to help you. And lastly, you know, Mac, if you know somebody that's suffering, we've got a great program. It's called Warrior Path. And if you know somebody that's suffering, you know, don't hesitate to reach out to us. And we've got, you know, maybe for your audience, we've got Marines on our staff that can talk to these guys, Marine to Marine, soldiers and sailors and a few airmen on the staff. So it's worth, you know, talking soldier to soldier and finding out the details. But, you know, get here, go through the program. It's not therapy. We don't teach you like a child. We teach you like, treat you like a Marine and hope to teach you, you know, a better way of living your life.
Josh, how about you?
If I take a page out of the book of my Jewish brother Drake, you know, I feel like I started from the bottom in all this, and I've been at the bottom and I've been at the top, and I think that when we talk about the idea of learning how to struggle well, and we talk about that it is a journey and a process, I think we're both testaments to that. You know, Ken lost his mom at a very young age, and I've been through my series of ups and downs, and I think in our lives continue to feature those, and we speak from personal experience of the journey we've been on, replicated in what we've seen through thousands of people. And so, you know, our hope is that, you know, it helps one person, and it goes from there. So, like Ken said, we're an open book, and we're open, and we're just hopeful of injecting some hope and possibility and direction into this world that seems to be lacking in all of the above. And I think, like Ken said, just listen to the words of Mattis. When in doubt, listen to the words of Mattis. Don't be a victim and don't accept being a victim. Once a warrior, always a warrior, and there's a way to continue living that no matter what you're doing with your life or what you're wearing.
The book is called Struggle Well, Thriving in the Aftermath of Trauma. The authors are Ken Fault and Josh Goldberg. Boys, first of all, I cannot say enough for not only thanking for you to come on and doing this today. The work that you guys do is incredible. And for those of us who pay attention and those of us who are advocates for different solutions other than medications and simply going to group therapy, you guys have moved the ball. And so I want to congratulate you, wish you continued good luck, not only with the book, but in your endeavors, both in Virginia and in Arizona, and the veteran world and the civilian world desperately needs you to keep doing what you're doing. I know you will, but thank you both very much for coming on All Marine Radio and doing this today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Mac. Thanks for having us, man. Thanks for what you do.
Yeah, Mac, thanks a lot. We're really honored to be on the show again, and we're here if you need anything.
That'll do it. The book is entitled Struggle Well, Thriving in the Aftermath of Trauma. The authors who've been gracious enough to join me today, Ken Falk and Josh Goldberg. You can buy that book, the Kindle version anyway, on Amazon.com right now for 99 cents. I would encourage you to do it. I would encourage you to shoot an email to everybody you know who deals with trauma. They might be a caregiver. They might be a spouse. They might be somebody who you know that's affected by it. 99 cents. It's a great read. You just heard two guys who've done a ton of work in this area, and now what they're trying to do is take this work and take it back to the civilian world and help anybody who's been affected. So my thanks to them for coming on. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.